Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Read with Michelle Martin on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
9:16 on the clock. You are on Money FM 89.3, Singapore's most influential radio station. I am reading Social Chemistry by Yale sociologist Marissa King. She's professor of organizational behavior at Yale. I think this is a great book. So fascinating. A research-based approach to networking, and a book meant for really anyone who can't leverage their networks or want to make the most of differing network modes available to us. Can be read on several levels as well, I think. A time to say welcome to author Marissa King. How are you?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to be with you, Michelle.
Thank you for being here. I want to jump right into the heart of the book. Why do you say our social networks is one of the most consequential decisions we can make about the trajectory of our lives?
We know from decades of research in the social sciences that our networks have an extraordinary impact on a huge variety of outcomes we care about. They're associated with your likelihood of getting a job, your pay, promotion, your physical health, your mental health, and even how long you're likely to live. But what's interesting is we are often given a really misguided message that it's the number of people you know or how large your network is. But in fact, that's not what predicts the vast majority of outcomes we care about. It's far more important, the quality of your connections and the structure of your network.
That's really interesting, and I want to dig into that. So why is it not the size of our social network that matters? And what do we mean by when we say it's the pattern and quality of our relationships that matter?
You know, we often focus on network size, how many people you know, because it's the easiest thing to conceptualize. But in many ways, our networks are actually maps. So you can map out the connections that exist between them. And that map is really a roadmap of where you've been in the past and where you're likely to go in the future. So, for instance, if your friends are friends with one another is much more consequential than just how many people you know.
And what do we mean by the pattern of our relationships? What are we looking for here?
Yeah, one of the analogies that I like to give is to think about carbon atoms. So if you take carbon atoms and you compose them in one way, in flat sheets, you get graphite. It's soft, it's cheap, right? You can find it in a backpack. But you take that same set of carbon atoms and you arrange them differently. And you get diamonds. They're hard, they're clear, they're valuable. The same is true with our social networks. And when we think about network structure, the same is true. If you take one group of people, and let's say it's a team at work, and everyone's talking to everyone in that team, you're going to have one set of benefits, a lot of trust. But you take that same team, split it into two separate groups with only one person in the middle, you're going to have a very different kind of team, that's one that's much more likely to be creative or innovative.
All right. Now, when it comes to building the networks, you say there are different types of roles that people can take or different types of networks, the expansionist, the broker, the convener. What are these basic types of roles that we can take in building our networks?
So there's three types that most people's networks fall into. We can think about conveners. Conveners' friends are all friends with one another. Conveners tend to invest a lot in maintaining their existing relationships. They may have lived in the same place for a long time or had the same job for a long time. They often don't like uncertainty or changing plans at the last minute, which tends to encourage them to build these networks that are really interconnected with a lot of depth. And the benefit of that type of network is that people who are conveners tend to be trusted. They have a lot of reputational benefits and they tend to have better mental health outcomes. The second type are brokers, and brokers are straddling two different social worlds. They may spend a lot of time, for instance, in working in an engineering department, but they also like to play bridge. And because those two groups normally don't talk to one another, by spanning them, brokers are really well positioned to be innovative and creative. They're often also good at making impromptu speeches on things they know nothing about. And that ability to translate new ideas is really key to their innovative success. And brokers also tend to have better work-life balance. And the final type are expansionists. And expansionists are often who we think of as quintessential networkers. They have very large networks. Most of us know around 650 people, but expansionists know thousands, which gives them a lot of influence, a lot of visibility, and they have the opportunity to really change minds.
Okay. I wonder if you can draw for us the links between cultivating your network and doing well at work and maybe even getting a pay rise.
Yeah, each of these different network types are suited for various stages, for instance, of your career. So we know early on in one's career, being an expansionist is really advantageous. If you're just starting off, you don't have that much access to new ideas and resources. So having a really large network is beneficial. Mid-career, it's most effective to be a broker because that innovation and creativity allows you to succeed in the workplace, increase your pay, increase your likelihood of promotion. But over time, that becomes really unwieldy. Like, you can broker between perhaps two or three or maybe even four groups, but it becomes really unmanageable. So at the end of the career, the most advantageous transition is actually to move towards this more convening, like, dense interconnected network where you're connected to other people in power who have a lot of trust. And this also helps guard against loneliness. And we actually know that loneliness is particularly endemic as people move up into the C-suite and the higher echelons of their career. So thinking about how you can change your network over time can actually have huge impacts for your career success.
Is there a part in the book where you talk about projecting different personality types to gain the trust of students?
So we can think about being able to both project different personality types, but for me, that's oftentimes what I've defaulted to when I'm feeling insecure or don't know what to do. And what we know is actually to increase trust, we need to be far more authentic in our interactions. And so actually trying to not move away from projecting personality types, but focusing much more on allowing people to see aspects of ourselves that are consistent with our values is really where trust comes from.
Okay, so I'm wondering what your book says about maybe creating new relationships or doing better with the ones we have.
Yeah, far too often I think we're focused on creating new relationships, but what we know from a lot of research is that a far better strategy is to invest in your existing network. For instance, research by Dan Levin at Rutgers has argued that one of the very best things you can do to strengthen your network is to reach out to what he calls a dormant tie, someone you haven't seen in 2 or 3 years. And while we often think like, oh my goodness, that's going to be so awkward, what will I say? Simply saying, I was thinking of you. In many ways, social connection is a gift in itself, or even asking for help, which allows the other person to have a sense of mastery. Reaching out to those old ties is really beneficial because, one, trust endures in relationships, but more importantly, that they're likely to give you new ideas and new insight, which the people you talk to on an everyday basis are far less likely to provide.
So we seem to be in such a hyper-connected world, and yet we're also seeing mental health issues increasing. Loneliness, certainly something that cities are trying to target through design thinking and the way they build homes for their population. Why do you think we're seeing a disparity between the growth of so-called social networks and maybe a sense of loneliness?
Yeah, one of the paradoxes is that we're more connected than ever, but we're also more lonely than ever. And I think what's at the heart of that is even though we're on video calls or emailing all the time, we're actually far more distracted, in part due to social media itself. And that distraction really impairs social connection. And one of the best things you can do to guard against that is actually to try to just simply be present and focused on the people you're with. Listen deeply.
And what can we learn from expansionists in terms of what they're doing to grow their social network? Because if social connection fades because you're not in touch, or, you know, you sort of slowly fade out of being in connection with a person, how do you then maintain such a vibrant connection when you have a vast social network?
One of the ways to maintain a really large network is it requires you actually being really intentional about it. And many people find that morally off-putting. Like, why would I want to be intentional about my relationships? But we all, no matter who you are, have cognitive limits on the number of people we can actually keep in mind. And we also have a fixed amount of time. So to maintain your network, you actually have to be quite systematic about it. Our feelings of closeness between people drops by more than 80% after 2 or 3 months of not seeing them. So being really thoughtful about keeping in mind like that you need to reach out to someone you haven't seen quite periodically to maintain that social connection. And another thing that we can learn from expansionists that's really key is they're huge givers, and they don't just give one-on-one to people they know, but they're, for instance, far more likely to donate blood and give to large organizations, which allows them to maintain a much broader community than if they were focusing on one-on-one interactions alone.
Speaking of intentional relationships, now we all know people who are difficult in life, you know, the people who thrive on gossip, or the people at work who, you know, create these circles of sycophants because they want support at work. So should we hold on to draining relationships? How do we deal with those?
That's one of the biggest mistakes people make far too often, is that if you think about your time as a fixed investment, far too often we hang on to relationships just because they're harder to let go. But if you can think of it as a trade-off, by letting one relationship that's not serving you go any longer and just letting that relationship go, and instead investing on the people who will help you thrive and to help you grow, it's a far better approach to thinking about how to maintain your relationships. And one of the things that I find so surprising is how much energy we devote to those negative relationships. It's said that we spend a far disproportionate amount of our time thinking about our negative relationships at work, even though less than 5% of our colleagues we would really consider negative ties, but we devote a disproportionate amount of our energy to focusing on those. So it's far better just to let them go and focus on the people who are going to help you grow.
Let the past go. All right. Now tell us about 6 degrees of separation, the idea that, you know, we're all about 6 social connections away from each other. How can we leverage this idea?
You know, one of the things that has been extraordinary in the social sciences is that Stanley Milgram first said that there's 6 degrees separates everyone in the world in the 1950s, a long time ago. But this is held true over time, and it's held true over time because the way that the social world is structured. So the reason we're all 6 degrees apart is because we're all in part of networks that are in part have these deep convening cores where there's a strong sense of community, a strong sense of connection. But we're also tied, those different social cliques or circles are tied together by brokers who bring them together. And then there's a little bit of randomness, which actually is the beauty of this whole thing, that on top of that consistent structure, that randomness really creates these shortcuts that allow us all to be connected. By so understanding where you are in that social space and what type of network you have, you can better understand what you have to offer to your community and your organization.
So as, you know, a professor who studies social networks, I'm sure the impact of the pandemic was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study, you know, what makes communities stay together or what makes some of them fall apart. So what did you take from the pandemic and how it impacts social networks?
Yeah, in my research, I found that our social networks have shrunk by 15% during the pandemic, and that was just through June. So there's likely been even a more contraction. But what's interesting is that that reduction in overall network size was almost entirely due to a shrinkage in men's networks. So men's networks shrunk by close to 30% or more than 400 people, but women's networks have hardly shrunk at all. And why I think that is so important is it's not that women have spent more time investing in their relationships, but they actually maintain their networks quite differently. And women are far more likely to maintain their relationships through conversation. For instance, and men instead tend to do things together. They may go to the bar together or play sports together. They do things together. And those differences really highlight that the key is figuring out how to make the most of your existing network and leverage your strengths, even during times when we're really struggling. And I think women's experience has been really instructive in that regard.
Absolutely fascinating book. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Marissa.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We're reading Social Chemistry, and you just heard the author there, Marissa King.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.